Time and Ebb. 1. In the first floriferous days of convalescence after a severe illness, which nobody, least of all the patient himself, expected a 90-year-old organism to survive, I was admonished by my dear friends Norman and Nora Stone to prolong the lull in my scientific studies and relax in the midst of some innocent occupation such as brazzle or solitaire. The first is out of the question, since tracking the name of an Asiatic town or the title of a Spanish novel through a maze of jumbled syllables on the last page of the evening newsbook, a feat which my youngest great-granddaughter performs with the utmost zest, strikes me as far more strenuous than toying with animal tissues. Solitaire, on the other hand, is worthy of consideration, especially if one is sensitive to its mental counterpart. For is not the setting down of one's reminiscences a game of the same order, wherein events and emotions are dealt to oneself in leisurely retrospection? Arthur Freeman is reported to have said of memoirists that they are men who have too little imagination to write fiction and too bad a memory to write the truth. In this twilight of self-expression, I, too, must float. Like other old men before me, I have discovered that the near in time is annoyingly confused, whereas at the end of the tunnel there are color and light. I can discern the features of every month in 1944 or 1945, but seasons are utterly blurred when I pick out 1997 or 2012. I cannot remember the name of the eminent scientist who attacked my latest paper, as I have also forgotten those other names which my equally eminent defenders called him. I am unable to tell offhand what year the embryological section of the Association of Nature Lovers of Reykjavik elected me a corresponding member, or when exactly the American Academy of Science awarded me its choicest prize. I remember, though, the keen pleasure which both these honors gave me. Thus a man, looking through a tremendous telescope, does not see the cirri of an Indian summer above his charmed orchard, but does see, as my regretted colleague, the late Professor Alexander Ivanchenko, twice saw, the swarming of Hesperozoa in a humid valley of the planet Venus. No doubt the numberless nebulous pictures bequeathed us by the drab, flat, and strangely melancholic photography of the past century exaggerate the impression of unreality which that century makes upon those who do not remember it. But the fact remains that the beings that peopled the world in the days of my childhood seem to the present generation more remote than the 19th century seemed to them. They were still up to their waists in its prudery and prejudice. They clung to tradition as a vine still clings to a dead tree. They had their meals at large tables around which they grouped themselves in a stiff sitting position on hard wooden chairs. Clothes consisted of a number of parts, each of which, moreover, contained the reduced and useless remnants of this or that older fashion. A townsman dressing of a morning had to squeeze something like 30 buttons into as many buttonholes, besides tying 3 knots and checking the contents of 15 pockets. In their letters they addressed perfect strangers by what was, insofar as words have sense, the equivalent of beloved master, and prefaced a theoretically immortal signature with a mumble expressing idiotic devotion to a person whose very existence was to the writer a matter of complete unconcern. They were atavistically prone to endow the community with qualities and rights which they refused to the individual. Economics obsessed them almost as much as theologies had obsessed their ancestors. They were superficial, careless, and short-sighted. More than other generations, they tended to overlook outstanding men, leaving to us the honor of discovering their classics. Thus, Richard Sinatra remained, while he lived, an anonymous ranger, dreaming under a telluride pine or reading his prodigious verse to the squirrels of San Isabel Forest, whereas everybody knew another Sinatra, a minor writer, also of Oriental descent. Elementary allobiotic phenomena led their so-called spiritualists to the silliest forms of transcendental surmise, and made so-called common sense shrug its broad shoulders in equally silly ignorance. Our denominations of time would have seemed to them telephone numbers. They played with electricity in various ways without having the slightest notion of what it really was. And no wonder the chance revelation of its true nature came as a most hideous surprise. I was a man by that time, and can well remember old Professor Andrews sobbing his heart out on the campus in the midst of a dumbfounded crowd. But in spite of all the ridiculous customs and complications in which it was entangled, the world of my young days was a gallant and tough little world that countered adversity with a bit of dry humor and would calmly set out for remote battlefields in order to suppress the savage vulgarity of Hitler or Alamillo. And if I let myself go, many would be the bright and kind and dreamy and lovely things which impassioned memory would find in the past. And then woe to the present age, for there is no knowing what a still vigorous old man might do to it if he tucked up his sleeves. But enough of this. History is not my field, so perhaps I had better turn to the personal, lest I be told, as Mr. Saskatchewanov is told by the most charming character in present-day fiction, corroborated by my great-granddaughter who reads more than I do, that every cricket ought keep to its picket, and not intrude on the rightful domain of other gads and summersmiths. 2. I was born in Paris. My mother died when I was still an infant, so that I can only recall her as a vague patch of delicious lacrimal warmth, just beyond the limit of iconographic memory. My father taught music and was a composer himself. I still treasure an ancient program where his name stands next to that of a great Russian. He saw me through my college stage and died of an obscure blood disease at the time of the South American War. I was in my 7th year when he and I, and the sweetest grandmother a child has ever been blessed with, left Europe, where indescribable tortures were being inflicted by a degenerate nation upon the race to which I belong. A woman in Portugal gave me the hugest orange I had ever seen. From the stern of the liner, two small cannon covered its portentously torturous wake. A party of dolphins performed solemn somersaults. My grandmother read me a tale about a mermaid who had acquired a pair of feet. The inquisitive breeze would join in the reading and roughly finger the pages so as to discover what was going to happen next. That is about all I remember of the voyage. Upon reaching New York, travelers in space used to be as much impressed as travelers in time would have been by the old-fashioned skyscrapers. This was a misnomer, since their association with the sky, especially at the ethereal close of a greenhouse day, far from suggesting any grating contact, was indescribably delicate and serene. To my childish eyes, looking across the vast expanse of parkland that used to grace the center of the city, they appeared remote and lilac-colored, and strangely aquatic, mingling as they did their first cautious lights with the colors of the sunset, and revealing with a kind of dreamy candor the pulsating inside of their semi-transparent structure. Negro children sat quietly upon the artificial rocks. The trees had their Latin binomials displayed upon their trunks, just as the drivers of the squat, gaudy, scaraboid motor cabs, generically allied in my mind to certain equally gaudy automatic machines upon the musical constipation of which the insertion of a small coin used to act as a miraculous laxative, had their stale photographic pictures affixed to their backs. For we lived in the era of identification and tabulation, saw the personalities of men and things in terms of names and nicknames, and did not believe in the existence of anything that was nameless. In a recent and still popular play dealing with the quaint America of the Flying Forties, a good deal of glamour is infused into the part of the soda jerk, but the side whiskers and the starched shirt fronts are absurdly anachronistic. Nor was there in my day such a continuous and violent revolving of tall mushroom seats as is indulged in by the performers. We imbibed our humble mixtures through straws that were really much shorter than those employed on stage, in an atmosphere of gloomy greed. I remember the shallow enchantment and the minor poetry of the proceedings, the copious froth engendered above the sunken lump of frozen synthetic cream, or the liquid brown mud or fudge sauce poured over its polar pate. Brass and glass surfaces, sterile reflections of electric lamps, the whir and shimmer of a caged propeller, a global war poster depicting Uncle Sam and his Rooseveltian tired blue eyes, or else a dapper uniformed girl with a hypertrophied nether lip. That pout, that sullen kiss trap, that transient fashion in feminine charm, 1939 through 1950. And the unforgettable tonality of mixed traffic noises coming from the street. These patterns and melodic figures, for the conscious analysis of which time is alone responsible, somehow connected the drugstore with a world where men tormented metals and where metals hit back. I attended a school in New York, then we moved to Boston, and then we moved again. We seem always to have been shifting quarters, and some homes were duller than others, but no matter how small the town, I was sure to find a place where bicycle tires were repaired, and a place where ice cream was sold, and a place where cinematographic pictures were shown. Mountain gorges seemed to have been ransacked for echoes. These were subjected to a special treatment on a basis of honey and rubber until their condensed accents could be synchronized with the labial movements of serial photographs on a moon-white screen in a velvet-dark hall. With a blow of his fist, a man sent a fellow creature crashing into a tower of crates. An incredibly smooth-skinned girl raised a linear eyebrow. A door slammed with the kind of ill-fitting thud that comes to us from the far bank of a river where woodsmen are at work. 3. I am also old enough to remember the coach trains. As a babe, I worshipped them. As a boy, I turned away to improved additions of speed. With their haggard windows and dim lights, they still lumber sometimes through my dreams. Their hue might have passed for the ripeness of distance, for a blending succession of conquered miles, had it not surrendered its plum bloom to the action of coal dust, so as to match the walls of workshops and slums which preceded a city as inevitably as a rule of grammar and a blot precede the acquisition of conventional knowledge. Dwarf dunce caps were stored at one end of the car and could flabbily cup, with the transmission of a diaphanous chill to the fingers, the grotto-like water of an obedient little fountain which reared its head at one's touch. Old men resembling the hoary ferrymen of still more ancient fairy tales chanted out their intermittent next stations and checked the tickets of travelers, among whom there were sure to be, if the journey was reasonably long, a great number of sprawling, dead-tired soldiers, and one live, drunken soldier, tremendously peripatetic, and with only his pallor to connect him with death. He always occurred singly, but he was always there, a freak, a young creature of clay, in the midst of what some very modern history textbooks glibly called Hamilton's period, after the indifferent scholar who put that period into shape for the benefit of the brainless. Somehow or other, my brilliant but unpractical father never could adapt himself to academic conditions sufficiently to stay very long in this or that place. I can visualize all of them. But one college town remains especially vivid. There is no need to name it if I say that three lawns from us, in a leafy lane, stood the house which is now the Mecca of a nation. I remember the sun-splashed garden chairs under the apple tree, and a bright copper-colored setter, and a fat, freckled boy with a book in his lap, and a handy-looking apple that I picked up in the shadow of a hedge. And I doubt whether the tourists who nowadays visit the birthplace of the greatest man of his time, and peer at the period furniture self-consciously huddled beyond the plush ropes of enshrined immortality, can feel anything of that proud contact with the past which I owe to a chance incident. For whatever happens, and no matter how many index cards librarians may fill with the titles of my published papers, I shall go down to posterity as the man who had once thrown an apple at Barrett. To those who have been born since the staggering discoveries of the 70s, and who thus have seen nothing in the nature of flying things save perhaps a kite or a toy balloon, still permitted, I understand, in several states, in spite of Dr. de Sutton's recent articles on the subject. It is not easy to imagine airplanes, particularly because old photographic pictures of those splendid machines in full flight lack the life which only art could have been capable of retaining. And oddly enough, no great painter ever chose them as a special subject into which to inject his genius and thus preserve their image from deterioration. I suppose I am old-fashioned in my attitude toward many aspects of life that happen to be outside my particular branch of science, and possibly the personality of the very old man I am may seem divided, like those little European towns, one half of which is in France and the other in Russia. I know this, and proceed warily. Far from me is the intention to promote any yearning and morbid regret in regard to flying machines, but at the same time I cannot suppress the romantic undertone which is inherent to the symphonic entirety of the past as I feel it. In those distant days, when no spot on earth was more than 60 hours flying time from one's local airport, a boy would know planes from propeller spinner to rudder trim tab and could distinguish the species not only by the shape of the wingtip or the jutting of a cockpit, but even by the pattern of exhaust flames in the darkness, thus vying in the recognition of characters with those mad nature sleuths, the post-Linnaean systematists. A sectional diagram of wing and fuselage construction would give him a stab of creative delight, and the models he wrought of balsa and pine and paper clips provided such increasing excitement during the making that, by comparison, their completion seemed almost insipid, as if the spirit of the thing had flown away at the moment its shape had become fixed. Attainment in science, retainment in art, the two couples keep to themselves, but when they do meet, nothing else in the world matters. And so I shall tiptoe away, taking leave of my childhood at its most typical point, in its most plastic posture, arrested by a deep drone that vibrates and gathers in volume overhead, stock still, oblivious of the meek bicycle it straddles, one foot on the pedal, the toe of the other touching the asphalted earth, eyes, chin, and ribs lifted to the naked sky, where a warplane comes with unearthly speed which only the expanse of its medium renders unhurried as ventral view of changes to rear view. And wings and hum dissolve in the distance. Admirable monsters, great flying machines, they have gone. They have vanished like that flock of swans which passed with a mighty swish of multitudinous wings one spring night above Knight's Lake in Maine. From the unknown into the unknown, swans of a species never determined by science, never seen before, never seen since. And then nothing but a lone star remained in the sky, like an asterisk, leading to an undiscoverable footnote.